Ahoy, authors! You're listening to the Writership Podcast, a show focused on helping indie authors master self-editing skills. So come aboard and get ready to find the treasure in your manuscript with hosts Leslie Watts and Clark Chamberlain.
Welcome to episode 90 of the Writership Podcast. I'm Leslie Watts, here with Clark Chamberlain from the Book Editor Show. Every week we show you editing in action with tips that you can use to improve your own stories. If you want to learn more about the Writership Podcast, you can visit the website at writership.com/podcast.
As you know, the Writership Podcast is brought to you by the good folks at Author Marketing Club, home of the new and improved Amazon Reviewer Grabber Tool. You know you need high-quality reviews for your book, so you should use the AMC Reviewer Grabber Tool to quickly and easily locate reviewers that are ready, willing, and able to review your books for you. Become a premium member of AMC now by visiting www.authormarketingclub.com and get instant access to this tool and more.
Okay. Hey, Clark.
Hey, how's it going, Leslie?
All right. We're going to change things up a little bit, and we're going to dive right into the quote this week.
Yeah, it's quote of the week from Deb Colletti. Every human being is, to some degree, an unreliable narrator. When we tell our stories to others, and even when we tell our stories to ourselves, we create our own version of events and of our lives as a whole. We don't necessarily mean to deceive, but we can see and understand our experiences from our own viewpoint. A shifting viewpoint at that. Facing the truth is a messy business. It involves denial and pride and the fact that understanding takes time. It relies on perspective or lack of it, and the pesky fact that we can only face the truth we can stand to face at any given moment. The unreliable narrator is an effective technique that makes for such a rich reading experience because we are all familiar with our own deceptions, confusions, and ego. And with the time, we wish the truth were different. With humanity of your protagonist is key. If the little lies and the tunnel vision and the character flaws that you create are those we know from our own lives, your reader will stay connected to your character. Finding the truth in the untruths will elevate your story. An unreliable narrator is not just a device, but also the skilled portrayal of a realistically flawed human being.
I just want to say yes. I agree.
Yes, absolutely. Like, you know, this entire last year, I've been doing so much on personal story, like the stories we tell ourselves, the way we get wrapped up in the stories that we've told and how they can hold us back and things like this, mm-hmm. and have taken that and like really, you know, tried to figure it out with like first person narration type stories and third person and, you know, first person present tense and how these different types of stories should actually look with that narrator, you know, telling the story and how they're going to come at it. It's such a fascinating idea.
Yeah.
And truth, actually.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I hadn't thought about it this way. I mean, I've thought separately about how everybody has, you know, obviously their own personal frame of reference and the way of seeing the world, and that is, you know, comes from, you know, shaped by our experiences and that sort of thing. But also the sense we make of those experiences. And so I knew that, like, on one side of my brain, perhaps, and then on the other side of my brain, I knew about the, you know, the unreliable narrators, and, you know, especially, I mean, the classics are Holden Caulfield and Humbert. But, you know, there are plenty of others, certainly. But just that, you know, those people who are, it's really obvious that they don't see the world the way the rest of us do, or, you know, they're either being dishonest about it or they just don't, you know, they're not capable of seeing things the way that they are. And, mm-hmm. and I loved this idea that, you know, everybody has that to a greater or lesser extent. And so, demonstrating that, showing how, you know, where your character's blind spots are, where they, you know, the places where they tell a fib or two, that those things are like, they convey the character flaws and, you know, and make them actually easier to relate to, when you're, you know, when you're trying to, especially when you have a character who's not super likable in the beginning, I think that that's really helpful to show how their flaws are connected.
Yeah, because, you know, when we come out this, and if you're like, no, come on, everybody just tells the truth and everybody sees the story the same way. Think about any story, anything that's happened to you in your life, like maybe what happened last weekend. And particular incident, how would you tell your parents that? How would you tell your coworkers that? And how would you tell your best friends that? I guarantee that each one of those stories would be different.
Ooh, yeah. That's so good, Clark. Oh my gosh. That's brilliant. Yeah. Because my mind was going off into, in my former work, you know, you get a lot of eyewitness testimony and you see how utterly flawed that is. Mm-hmm. But, oh, that is so good that, yeah, how do you tell a story? I've been trying to talk with my kids a little bit about that, you know, about how, well, when you're with grandma and papa, you need to, you know, certain words we, you know, just don't say with them. And when you're with your friends, you know, that's more acceptable. And, you know, talking about this. So, oh, wow. I love it. I feel like my brain just got a
well, you know, like, because it really... And I don't know if you, we did it on the Book Editor Show. We talked about first person present tense. Mm-hmm. And it was one of these deals where I was really trying to wrap my brain around why I didn't like it. And it's because of this type of stuff. You know, it's the storytelling method. Because if I'm first person past tense, it means I'm telling a story to somebody, one of these three types of people.
Right.
But if I'm in present tense, then I'm telling the story to myself. I'm living the story. It's how I'm experiencing it, which is a different type of unreliable narrator, because it's how I see myself versus how I think other people see me and how I would want that story to sound to them.
Right.
So it's such a fascinating thing in how we do this. And it's just what we do. This is how every one of us operates.
Right. Yes. Oh my gosh. Okay. This makes me even more excited about our discussion. Okay. So we have a great opening to share with you today. We have Kill Screen by Benjamin Reeves. This is literary science fiction thriller, and it's a novel. And it's been published, so we'll include a link in the show notes for that in case you want to read on. The total word count is about 63,000 words, and this is a little gory and involves a suicide scene. So if that's not your scene, then you might want to skip this one. So, all right, Clark, take it away.
Chapter 1, Bloodbath. Dexter's body was bloated and blue by the time I found it floating in a bath of his own blood. One arm hung over the side of the tub, the slash on his wrist squinting at me like an evil, bloody eye. Suicide. It wasn't my first dead body. It wasn't my first suicide. It wasn't my first discovery of a mangled loved one. But you never grow accustomed to sorrow. Numbed by the surreal, dreamlike quality of the scene in front of me, I sat down on the lid of the toilet next to his husk. The day's events began to whirl around me like a hurricane. I had begun to suspect that something was wrong with Dexter when he failed to show up to work. He hadn't returned any of my calls that day, and by the time I left the office, I was beginning to worry. It was worse than I could have imagined. He had drawn himself a bath of his own blood. Dexter and I had fought the day before. In the haze of the tragedy, I couldn't remember most of the specifics. Lately, he'd been taking a lot of time off work, tinkering with a few personal projects. I needed his brain. I needed him to program our game back at the office. He didn't understand why I made a big deal out of deadlines. He never understood deadlines. That had been our last exchange. It was a stupid way to end a relationship. My whole world felt inverted. Earlier in the day, I'd been fretting over a list of bug fixes our middling video game company had yet to implement for an upcoming project. I'd been arguing with my programming team about whether or not we could efficiently stream video off a disc and cursing Dexter for playing hooky. Now, all that passion was drained out of me. Who cared if our game had a bug list as long as my femur? While I was at the office arguing about programming priorities, Dexter was in his bathtub, opening his wrists. His body must have lain there for hours before I finally made my way over to his house to check on him. I knocked on his front door 3 times without getting an answer, and I started to leave, until a gnawing in my gut drove me back. Snatching the spare key from the doorframe, I let myself in. Dexter lived alone in a house too big for one person. He'd grown up in a large manor, and I think all the empty space made him comfortable. That night, the dark corners of his home overwhelmed me. How had he ever found peace in this place? The living room TV had been left on. It splashed random colors across the empty couch. An ad for a local jewelry store spun out soft piano music. "It's what your loved ones deserve," echoed a rich baritone. There was no sign of Dexter. I wandered the house, looking for a life that no longer existed. The bathroom door was shut. Through a crack between the door and the floorboards, I could see the lights were on. A subtle but malodorous odor drifted from under the door. I rapped on the towering rectangle of wood in front of me. "Hey, Dex, you in there?" No response. I knocked a little louder. "Dexter!" Still nothing. I tried the handle, and the door creaked open. The odd details are the ones I remember most. The floor's noisy squeak as I stepped forward, my own distorted reflection in the bathroom window, the once white threads of a bath mat soaked pink as they broke above the surface of a red pool. I didn't see Dexter at first. He was invisible to me. All I could see was the deep redness of his bathwater. I knew there was something wrong with this scene. But I stared into the tepid bath for a long while before my brain was able to piece together. I felt like my mind was running through sludge. I couldn't process the colors and the shapes in front of me. Then I looked into Dexter's bloody third eye, and reality came into sharp focus. My friend was dead. He looked like a gutted fish. He had spread his life across the bathroom tiles, bloated and blue. The razor blade sat on the island of his belly in the middle of a red bath. Dexter's blood had swamped the bathroom floor. One arm hung over the side of the tub. The open gash in his wrist winked at me as if I had just been hit with the punchline of a terribly offensive joke. Numbed by the surreal dreaminess of the moment, I passed the rest of the night in a haze. There were phone calls, flashing lights, and EMTs. I remember the parts, but I don't know how, where, or when they fit together. The TV remained on, playing an old 80s movie about a woman on a suicidal vengeance quest. The police brought questions and paperwork. The EMTs took the bloated body, blue corpse, away in a body bag. I left a half-brewed pot of coffee and a trash can full of vomit in the kitchen sink. When there were no more questions or flashing lights, I was left with my memories and regrets and the inescapable image of a winking bloody eye.
Hey, thank you. It's really interesting to me the more that I go over this, that, you know, that it's a great example of a protagonist that's not, you know, he's not warm and fuzzy. He's not super likable in the beginning, but he's really intriguing. And so we have this mystery about what's happened, you know, about what happened to his friend. And we can be, you know, curious about that certainly and what led to his death. But also this really odd guy who's his friend is kind of, you know, it's really intriguing and maybe even more compelling for me in terms of the story and what's, you know, what's interesting to me than necessarily the, you know, what happened to, you know, what happened to Dexter, because it looks straightforward at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. Except to the fact that it wasn't my first dead body. It wasn't my first suicide. It wasn't my first discovery of a mangled loved one. You know, like,
right?
As you're reading that in the opening, you're thinking to yourself, or I was, oh, this is a cop who's at a crime scene. Because cops at crime scenes see lots of stuff like this.
Right.
I don't equate computer programmer guys walking in on a lot of scenes like this. So
right.
What's his life like? What? Why? Why is his life thrown in with death? But not just death, but like discovering death and seeing all this stuff.
Yeah. So. Including suicides. And I wonder, I wonder if maybe that they do these, like maybe they do games, and maybe one of their games is, you know, kind of like this. And So, you know, and so they, anyway, it's just a possibility, but yeah, that's a great question. And I think that he's an interesting, like there's some really interesting contrasts because, we have these, you know, he seems to speak tenderly at times where, you know, he speaks of sorrow, a loved one, you know, he was wondering had Dexter found peace in his home, that he felt overwhelmed by the dark corners. There were memories and regrets, like all of this is like, you know, kind of tender language, but then he's also very blunt. He refers to the husk when he's talking about his, you know, his loved one's body, right? He's talking about how he opened his wrist. He's talking about gutted fish. He's talking about the razor blade, you know, floating on the island of his belly. And so that all is very blunt and just a different, it conveys a different attitude about what's going on.
Because, you know, the question is when you're approaching this is like, why tell the story in this manner, right? What is it that wanting the reader to see here? You know, because we know Dexter's dead. We know Dexter's dead at the very beginning. So we know that he killed himself. But then we're jumping back, right? Like we were talking off air, we're jumping back to a couple of days before, because Dexter's taking a lot of time off work. We're jumping to, you know, the day before. We're jumping to the fight before. We're jumping to all these different things. We're jumping all over the place, jumping forward to the police investigation. And so what is it that the protagonist is trying to get us to believe in telling the story in this way?
Yeah. It's a great question, because what is he trying to do?
Yeah.
So but, I want to know.
I want to know too. And so like if you're using unreliable narrator, and this is our assumption here that we're using an unreliable narrator, that this is a great way to do this. Like you really have to think about how you're telling the story, where you're leading the reader, what it is that you're really having them pay attention to, and what are you glossing over, right? You know, like we don't honestly know if this is what really happened, because he's telling us this, right? Like, right?
Yeah.
You know, and he's telling us in summary, like just summarizing through all this stuff. So we really don't know, and we're not getting the feeling, we're not getting any of that kind of stuff. So instead, us as the reader is putting together a picture ourselves, and the protagonist is trying to feed us a particular story.
Right. And so, yeah, we have these little like puzzle pieces that we, as the reader, you know, like he gives us a little something and we put, you know, plug it in and try to make it make sense with all of the other pieces that we're getting. And so I think, yeah, that this is not somebody I would, you know, I would trust, right? I wouldn't trust his rendition of the facts. And so I think it's a great setup. And you know, what the line that I thought was a really good way of boiling this down was that the odd details are the ones I remember most. Like, yeah, dude, those are the, well, at least those are the ones you're telling us about, you know, so it's really, that's really, it's interesting. and an interesting way to set up. But you bring up a good point about, you know, like, how are we telling the story? Because we're not getting the scene where the police arrive, or where he, you know, where he even calls the police, mm-hmm. or the argument, you know, and so this might all be intentional.
Because he doesn't even remember the specifics about the argument, as he's telling us.
Yeah.
In the haze of tragedy, I couldn't remember most of the specifics. You know, we had fought the day before. And so, like, this is the type of stuff, right, that you're asking, like, what is it? What can we do with that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now let's say that you're let's take a look at this in another way, though, just real quick. Flip side on this is that, let's say you're not doing an unreliable narration. Let's just say that you wanted to kick off your scene with this amazing first line: Dexter's body was bloated blue by the time I found it floating in a bath of his own blood. Okay, because that opening paragraph mm-hmm. is going to suck anybody in and make them pay attention.
Yeah, it's a great hook.
Yeah, it is a really good hook, but then the going back and just kind of, you know, just tossing in these details, that doesn't make it as strong, right? Because we already know that we already know he's dead. We already know that's what's going on. And so, like, if you're having him go through and try to add some kind of tension with him opening up the bathroom door, we already know what's on the other side of that door. Mm-hmm. So if this was not your intention to do this unreliable narration, like we're saying is here, and your intention was just to hook someone at the beginning, you may have to rethink it. Or you may have to flash forward and tell the rest of the story different, because you don't want to just end up summarizing a whole bunch of stuff just because you wanted to use that really cool opening line.
Right. And, you know, and we don't necessarily need to have all of the, you know, all of the events that led up to him finding the body. Like, we don't need to... I was just trying to think of his name, and I don't think we don't get his name. We don't get the protagonist's name in here, but his name is Jack. So Jack, we don't necessarily need all of these details right now. So we could get those later on. Like, we could flash back to the argument and actually see the scene, or we could flash back to the day when he was having a discussion with people about a project and was feeling, internally he was kind of cursing Dexter for not showing up and that kind of thing. So if it's important, we could, you know, we don't have to have it all now. We can delay that. So there are lots of options for this. And it just depends, like you say, on the story that the author wants to tell and how they want to, you know, like, what pieces that he wants us to have right now as opposed to later or never. Because there are some details we probably, you know, obviously we won't see because they're not relevant to the story. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's all about that control. And it's one of the things that I, you know, like, we're talking about this unreliable narrator. I want to, like, just say again about narrators, you know, and don't just pick a point of view because, and a tense because you think it's popular. Like, really decide what kind of story you're trying to tell and what way the narrator is going to be able to best deliver that story. First person, third person, omniscient, you know, limited, present tense, past tense, and really get a good idea of that, because then that's going to help you manipulate the reader the right way, you know, to make sure that you're really going to have full control of the story and what information you give the reader and when they're going to have it.
Yeah. Because if we're in first person and throughout the story, then anything that's not experienced or, you know, or observed by that character has to come in some other way, right? And, you know, so that, and then you have the limitation in third person omniscient, right? You have a much wider a wider angle, but you don't get as tight, so you don't get in on the character's thoughts, the specific words that they're thinking and that kind of thing. So there are, obviously advantages and disadvantages of each kind. And as you say, it's so important to pick the one that's going to enable you to reveal the story as you envision it and the best way to tell it. Because there are lots of different ways to tell a story, the same story, which we keep circling that idea that you can, right, you can read about an event in a fiction, a fictionalized version of events, or you can, read a newspaper article, or you can, read like an article in a magazine, which might be a little different, or a blogger, talking about there are so many different ways to tell a story, and you have all these options and tools at your disposal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just make sure you're choosing the right ones.
Yeah. So I felt like I wanted a little more setting, and mm-hmm. I like it when we have, when we have a few details and then, we get to kind of fill in with our own details because it allows us to put ourselves in the setting. But here I felt like I wasn't quite grounded enough in the space, and that may have been intentional. But also in the time, I mean, it's obviously somewhat contemporary, but it's, just because of the technology that they're talking about. But it doesn't, but I wanted a little more clear, a little more I wanted some more details about the house so that are we, to help me understand is Jack, how is Jack's filter, giving, affecting, how he sees the house. Is it actually a big house, or is it actually kind of a normal sized house and Jack just thinks it's big, those kinds of things. And I didn't know, this could be the US, or it could be, it could be the UK, it could be anywhere. And I may have missed a detail that indicated that, but I didn't, I didn't have that. So I kind of wanted a little more there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there was something, something you just had said that I thought was really important there. Okay. Darn. Sorry.
The filter.
I don't recall. I don't recall. So, but those were good things.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Oh no, I got it.
Go.
But just like you were saying, yeah. So make sure you've got like a foil or something else, because if you're going to have an unreliable narrator, the only way we know it's completely unreliable is getting from someone else's perspective,
right?
How they see it. So we got to have something to compare.
Yeah. And I was thinking of this when, you jogged my memory about something about this, that, that he's not actually, Jack's not interacting with anyone in this, in this opening scene. So we don't have any kind of, any way to tell how far off he is, or how, we know he's unreliable, but we don't know how far. And might not necessarily need that right away in the first scene, but it's, it's something that you would definitely need, that as the foil, as you say, the person who's going to help us figure out where Jack is on that continuum of unreliability.
Do you have a mission that would help people create unreliable characters?
Well, I've been thinking about this. It's funny you should mention this. And I was thinking about unreliable characters and this broader view of, that we're all sort of unreliable or dishonest with ourselves and others in different ways. And so I want you to think about that. So even if you don't have a character like Holden Caulfield or Humbert Humbert or even Jack, there are things that your character can't see about himself and about the world around him. So I suggest that you do a timed writing session for 10 to 20 minutes and explore where your protagonist is less than sincere, like I said, with himself and with other people, and consider what the positive and negative story relevant consequences are for him and the people around him as a result of his limitations. And then the flip side, spend the same amount of time writing about the ways in which your character is completely aware and completely trustworthy. Like when they share on the subject of X, they are completely forthright and they can see clearly. So, and then ask yourself, do any consequences flow from that that are relevant to your story? So then I want you to take your manuscript and see if your understanding of the character is showing up in the character's thoughts, in their behaviors, in the reactions that the other characters have to them, so that you're making sure that the essence of the character that you have in your heart and mind is showing up on the page. And a reminder that you can go to writership.com/episodes to sign up to get these editorial missions delivered right to your inbox. So, because if you usually listen while on the go, it can be tricky to start, you know, writing down all these notes about how your characters are unreliable. So this is a great solution. We just happen to have provided.
Talking about providing, the Writership podcast is brought to you by the good folks at the Author Marketing Club, which you can find at www.authormarketingclub.com. Don't forget, when you become a premium member today, you'll gain access to the new and improved Amazon Reviewer Grabber Tool.
And before we go, if you enjoy the show and get a lot out of it, please leave us a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher. If you have 5 pages of your work of fiction that you want us to review, please visit writership.com/submissions. Finally, be sure to check out the Book Editor Show, which Clark hosts with Peter Turley. That's it for episode 90. We'll see you next time on the Writership Podcast.
Ready for Leslie and Clark to help you find the treasure in your manuscript? Submit your pages to writership.org/podcast.